3. The Demise of the Safavid Order and the Unhappy Interregnums, 1666 to 1797. On October the 23rd, 1722, after 7 months of siege and suffering the horrors of famine and disease, the last of the Safavid rulers, Shah Sultan Hussein, reigned 1694 to 1722, walked out of Isfahan's city gate, accompanied by his courtiers and officials, and abdicated in favour of Mahmud Hataki, the chief of the Ghalzai Afghan invaders. For the previous decade, Mahmud, the Sunni chief of an Afghan tribal force, had wrought havoc in the eastern Safavid provinces before reaching the walls of the Safavid capital. The Shah personally removed from his Gazilbash cap the bejeweled pin symbolizing his royal authority and secured it onto Mahmud's turban. A few days later, the Afghan chief, accompanied by the former Safavid Shah, entered Isfahan and was enthroned in the Chehel Sotun, 40 columns, palace, as Mahmud Shah. This effectively brought to an end a dynasty that had ruled for 221 years, longer than any dynasty in the history of Islamic Iran. For most people of Isfahan, who observed the events with horror, it was a catastrophe of unequaled magnitude. The fall of the Safavids resonated in Persian consciousness throughout the 18th century. Even though there was a brief Safavid restoration under Sultan Hussein's son, Tahmasp II, reigned 1732 to 1736, and despite at least three later attempts to reconstitute, reform, or reshape the shattered empire, in the end only the memory of the fallen dynasty lingered. 20th century historiography treats the fall of the Safavids as the end of a long period of decline that had politically and militarily weakened Iran and eventually plunged it into political strife and economic decay. The question of decline, in particular, had engaged observers even before the fall of the Safavids. Unlike the neighbouring Ottoman and Mughal empires, the former partially modernised and survived up to the 20th century, and the latter colonised piecemeal and was dismantled in the 18th and 19th centuries, the dramatic collapse of the Safavids and their surrender to a small tribal army raises questions about the economic and administrative problems of the empire, as well as political legitimacy, Shi'i identity, changes long occurring at the Iranian periphery, and shifting regional patterns across the Eurasian world. The Unraveling of the Safavids. When Abbas I died in 1629, he had not groomed a successor. Of his four sons, one had died, two others were executed at his own order, and one was blinded on feigned charges of treason. His brutal treatment of his own offspring accelerated the internecine killings in the Safavid house and among its successors. Abbas I's grandson, a minor, crowned as Shah Safi, reigned 1629 to 1642. Shortly after his accession, put to death many of the princes of the royal family eligible to ascend the throne, as well as some officials and army officers. Although vicious, even by 17th century standards, Safi's actions prevented a war of succession. The weakening of the old elite inadvertently opened the way for a new breed of administrators of non-Gezilbash origin, who, for most of the next century, would dominate the Safavid state and steer it toward greater centralization. Destruction of the Imam Goli Khan, the powerful and accomplished governor-general of Fars province, extended the long arm of the central government to the commercial and agricultural revenue of the southern provinces. The Grand Vizier, Saru Taki, a capable minister in office between 1634 and 1645, dominated the Divan and the army and effectively ruled on Safi's behalf. Such delegated power, though potentially resulting in separation of the state's administrative arm from the court, did not translate into political security for the Grand Viziers or into the steady growth of an institutionalized state, free from the Shah's meddling. A similar ministerial drive for state-building, as well as the same royal obstructionism, would also occur later, during the tenure of Sheikh Ali Khan Zangyaneh, Grand Vizier between 1668 and 1689, and again under Fat Ali Khan Dagestani between 1694 and 1721, during the last days of Safavid rule. A glance at late Safavid administrative charts such as those found in Tazkirat al-Muluk, Memorandum for the Rulers, reveals an elaborate state machinery, well-staffed and with a relatively sensible division of labour, presiding over a vast system encompassing revenue collection, the judiciary, the court and the army. Yet the inherent problem of insecurity in high office, especially for the Grand Viziers, persisted and was aggravated because of the Ghulam origins of some and the slave-like status of other holders of high office. Safavid ministers never mustered enough power from the ruler to check the whims of the monarch or harness the wishes of the court. It is worth noting that the symbolic separation of the Ottoman Sublime Porte, Bab-e-Ali, from the Sultan's court in the middle of the 17th century, which over time added to the administrative power of the Grand Vizier, never occurred in the Safavid state. Despite their remarkable attempts to build an administrative base, by the late 17th century, the Safavid Divan had already been hollowed out by factionalism and deadly rivalries. The declining governance of the late Safavid Shahs also contributed to the steady weakening of the state. As eligible princes of the royal family, nearly all the late Safavid rulers were brought up in the confinement of the harem. This deliberate isolation was designed to avert rebellious aspirations, a practice similar to the Ottomans' cage, gafas, policy. Under the supervision of the harem eunuchs, who acted as virtual parents, these princes were largely devoid of public experience and political education before coming to the throne. In the male-dominated public world of court and government, their insecurities translated into impulsive behaviour. At times, they demonstrated symptoms of paranoia, even insanity, triggered by bad habits. Safi died of alcoholism at the age of 30. Abbas II reigned 1642 to 1666, apparently of syphilis at the age of 33, and Suleiman reigned 1666 to 1694, of what was diagnosed as gout at the age of 47. As part of a global pattern, syphilis was raging through Europe. It was introduced to Iran via the Ottoman Empire, reaching almost epidemic proportions by the late 17th century. It was known in Iran as Farangi, or European disease, among other names. The 17th century French traveller Jean Chardin claimed that nearly half of the Iranian population had contracted the disease. Even if we treat his opinion with scepticism, it is probable that some members of the royal family suffered from it. Frequent sexual contacts with many partners in and out of the harem no doubt facilitated contracting the disease. References in Safavid sources to royal deaths caused by excessive sexual intercourse can be taken as an indication of prevalent venereal diseases. Excessive wine drinking and addiction to a variety of opiates, hashish-based potions and narcotics in the promiscuous climate of the late Safavid court may also have been remedies for syphilitic pain and suffering. Among the members of the royal house, behaviour such as abrupt killings, mutilation, self-inflicted wounds, and utter feebleness might be taken as either withdrawal symptoms or as signs of mental degeneration associated with contracted or congenital syphilis. Despite all this, degenerate princes and inefficient state machinery were not unique to the Safavids, nor were they, by themselves, potent enough to bring down a venerable state. Indeed, so far as the subjects of the empire were concerned, the 17th century was one of the longest, most prosperous, urbane and peaceful episodes they had ever witnessed. The reign of Abbas II, in particular, epitomized an age of economic prosperity and social calm. Despite the decay that gradually set in, the late Safavid artistic and intellectual endeavours, refined material culture, and freer contact with the outside world, distinguished this period as one of the most exciting in early modern period. Such prolonged age of tranquility can be viewed as a peace dividend, primarily resulting from the Zohab Treaty of 1639, which immunized Iran against the familiar Ottoman threat for 8 decades. Yet domestically too, Safavid society had reached a certain cultural maturity well evident in intellectual and artistic expressions of the period. It may be argued that existential questions that engrossed the celebrated Safavid philosopher Mullah Sadr about resurrection of the body or the cultural incentives that motivated the influential theologian Majlisi to write tomes on the intricacies of ritual hygiene, were both aspects of a common desire to preserve the body rather than deny it, as classical Sufi doctrine advocated. Likewise, the paintings and poetry of the period, at times daring and expressive, sought to break away from the constraints of Shi'i piety. They came to represent a more realistic picture and in-depth expression of the self. Safavid poetry, though, never returned to the heights it had achieved during the classical age, also presented a new sense of awareness of Safavid surroundings and the poetic self. Sa'eb Tabrizi, 1601-1677, a master poet of 17th century Isfahan, who also spent some years at the Mughal court, demonstrated in his poetry technical marvels and aesthetic complexity, along with a novel cosmopolitan outlook reflective of the tranquil spirit of his time. The originality found in these artistic and literary expressions lay in their greater appeal to the common man. Besides the Safavid poetry produced at the court and under elite patronage in Iran, as in Mughal India, poetry gave voice to the lesser-known and amateurs. Merchants, artisans, and ordinary folks were less interested in set themes and tropes of courtly culture, and more in earthy pleasures, everyday life, and even unorthodox beliefs, always expressed using allegorical language. Perhaps not technically as sophisticated, the amateur oral poets of the bazaar conveyed the aspirations of the ordinary people better than the panegyrists of the court. As they recited their odes, ghazals, in poetic gatherings and at coffee houses, one cannot fail to detect a joyous inspiration and spirit of scepticism, at times with sexual undertones. Admiring the beauty of youth, often male, became acceptable through the lyrics and paintings of the period. The culture of leisure and pastime was appealing to the urban public. Despite occasional religious sanctions, the number of coffee houses, taverns, and pleasure houses, as brothels were known, increased throughout the realm. Consumption of tea and coffee, the former from China and later from India, and the latter from Arabia and the Levant, made coffee houses an alternative to taverns. In the mid-17th century, we know there were at least 6 major coffee houses in Isfahan alone. Poetic competitions, mashaere, chess matches, card and board games, music and dancing, and readings of the Shahnameh and other action-packed Persian epics and romances attracted the male public as well as the royals. On their nocturnal rounds, Abbas I, and later his successors, visited coffee houses and listened to poetry readings, one of the reasons, no doubt, for these public venues' survival, even though they were frowned upon by the ulama. Later on, storytellers of the Safavid coffee houses incorporated into their repertoire Shi'i stories and performances, such as the popular Hamzeh-Nameh, which narrated in accessible language the fantastic exploits of Hamzeh, the prophet's uncle. Other epics in praise of Ali, the first imam, were also recited in public by storytellers. The clergy, and at times government authorities, remained suspicious of the coffee houses' subversive ambiance, of their habitués and their storytellers. And not without reason. Jean Chardin informs us that free and open expressions of beliefs and opinions, presumably religious and political, in the Isfahan coffee houses were unique in the world. As part of a global trend, one cannot fail to note the budding Safavid public space, comparable not only to similar Ottoman and Egyptian establishments, but also to French salons and English coffee houses of the period. Wine drinking also was a popular pastime, with wine consumed, as often noted, in immoderate quantities. The late Safavid era witnessed successive anti-drinking campaigns orchestrated by the ulama under Abbas II, Suleiman, and Sultan Hussein. Targeted mostly at the general public, these crusades also obliged the court to destroy its precious wine cellars, even though prohibition could not easily change old habits. As part of the drinking culture, there were various establishments for the consumption of narcotics, often highly addictive derivatives of opium, which were also widely used by the public and taxed by the government. Prostitution, both female and male, was also tolerated by society and taxed and regulated by the state, which considered prostitution inevitable, especially during military campaigns. Although tobacco smoking did not become a national habit in Iran until the early 19th century, it was fashionable among the elite of the late Safavid era. Reaching Iran from the New World via Europe and the Ottoman Empire in the early 17th century, tobacco quickly found its own place among the courtiers. Although under Abbas I there was an initial resistance to smoking, that did not stop the cultivation of tobacco in Iran. A century later, by the late 18th century, despite anti-smoking campaigns, the popularity of the Persian pipe, chopok, and water pipe, kalyan, superseded opiate and other drugs. These and other leisure activities and social habits presented a very different side of Safavid society from that of the purist pursuits of the jurists. The leisure culture flourished with greater urbanization. Even though one should not exaggerate the grip of either religion or leisure on late Safavid society, it is difficult to ignore the sense of social laxity, even complacency, at least in the urban centers of the empire. Resurgence of the periphery. Despite relative urban calm in the late Safavid era, pressure on the empire's frontiers continued to build. Following the death of Abbas I in 1629, Iran experienced yet another Ottoman onslaught, this time under Sultan Murad IV, the last of the great Ottoman conquerors. After nearly three decades of calm and without any provocation, massive Ottoman armies occupied the western Iranian provinces. Facing resistance in Tabriz and Hamadan, the Ottomans did not hesitate to massacre the population and lay waste to cities. In 1638, Baghdad also fell into Ottoman hands, this time permanently. Despite stiff Iranian resistance, the Safavid state acted circumspectly. The conclusion in 1639 of the Treaty of Zohab once again called for the Ottomans' evacuation of western Iran in exchange for the permanent annexation of southern Iraq. The fragile border between the two empires thus was set roughly along the lines of the previous 1555 Amasya Treaty, even though Iran has to face yet another Ottoman occupation in the early 18th century. On another front, facing the Uzbeks' recurring attacks also obliged the Safavids to act with caution, as the central state began to feel the financial burden of waging war on two fronts. The centralizing policies of Abbas I and his successors transformed most semi-autonomous provinces, Mamolek, into crown property. Direct control brought greater revenue, especially in Fars, the Caucasus, and Khorasan, but it also made the empire more vulnerable on the periphery. To remedy such peripheral pressures, Abbas has already implemented a complex policy of tribal resettlement. The nomadic defensive walls in the west and east temporarily fended off the external threat while diminishing tribal tensions in the interiors. As many as 15,000 Kurdish families resettled in northern Khorasan so as to create a dependable barrier against the Uzbeks' forays. But by the last quarter of the 17th century, the Safavid Empire, like its Muslim neighbors to the west and the east, encountered increased threats along its frontiers and trade routes from a variety of nomadic powers. In the Caucasus, the Lezgian tribes of Dagestan and other semi-nomadic peoples of the Transcaucasus, including the Cossacks, ravaged the prosperous Shirvan region and threatened the overland Caspian trade. To the west, the Kurdish tribes of the Persian and Ottoman frontiers captured Kermanshah and Hamadan, both centers for trade of Mesopotamia and the Levant. In the south, the coastal Arab tribes, often in collaboration with Omani pirates based in and around Muscat, posed a similar threat to the Persian Gulf trade. In Khuzestan, the remnants of the Mashasha autonomous region in the marshlands of Hoveza were in periodic rebellion, and in the southeast, the Baluch tribes of the Makran region began to make raids on the eastern trade with Hindustan. This unrest at the periphery was not uncommon, especially during times of trouble in the center. Yet the simultaneous revolt of so many frontier forces at once was highly unusual. The most significant and fatal blow came from the revolt of the Galzai Afghan tribes of Kandahar province in today's southern Afghanistan. A coveted Safavid southeastern stronghold and frontier trade center, the possession of Kandahar was long disputed by the Mughal Empire. Though by 1653 the Safavids had managed to make Kandahar their own, Their reassertion of city control bred much anti-Persian sentiment. As early as 1701, after several petitions to the Safavid court, Mir Vesa Hataki, the mayor, Chalantar, of Kandahar, who resented the anti-Sunni policies of the Safavid state, rose in rebellion and murdered the Safavid governor-general of the province, who was a Georgian of Golam origin. Mir Vesa was supported by his Galzai kinsmen in the vicinity of the city and backed by the Mughal emperor, Aurangzeb, reigned 1658 to 1707. Aurangzeb's policy toward the Safavids was guided not only by Mughal territorial claim over Kandahar, but also by a new spirit of Sunni reassertion. The Kandahar rebellion, also blessed by the anti-Shia fatwas of the Meccan jurists, successfully resisted the Safavids' reprisal. Less than 2 decades later, Mir Vey's son, Mahmud, in collusion with subordinate Afghan and Baluch tribes, felt confident enough to raid the Iranian interior and go as far as attempting to lay siege to the cities of Kerman and Yazd, albeit unsuccessfully. These would be rehearsals for what came in 1722, when Mahmud Hataki laid siege to Isfahan, a city virtually intact and long unaccustomed to nomadic incursions. Shah Sultan Hussein proved utterly helpless in his handling of the Afghan crisis. He was the quintessential product of a confined upbringing in the harem. Even if we allow for some exaggeration in the European and Ottoman eyewitness accounts of the Safavid capital, they convincingly portray a government on the verge of collapse, with rebellions and insurrections in the making, an army unprepared to fight, statesmen and army chiefs in the throes of ethnic and factional disputes, and an indecisive Shah incapable of controlling his quarrelling courtiers, many wives, eunuchs, clerical dignitaries, and corrupt officials. Shortly before the attack by the Afghans, the elimination of Fat Ali Khan Dagestani, the Grand Vizier, and decimation of his allies in the Safavid army on charges of Sunni proclivities shook not only the administrative and financial stability of the empire, but also its defences. The downfall of the shrewd Lezgian minister, who earlier had established his power base in Georgia, was one example of how the spread of Shi'ism in the Safavid realms gradually eroded tribal support for the empire on the Sunni periphery. The air of complacency that had set in at the Isfahan court after decades of trouble-free lives of both luxury and laxity, as well as zealous religious policies, was to be rudely interrupted by the arrival of a half-starving, ragged band of nomads. At the Battle of Gulnabad on the outskirts of Isfahan in May 1722, the more numerous and better equipped Safavid forces were defeated by no more than 20,000 Afghans, who forced the Safavids to retreat behind the city walls. Somewhat surprised by the ease with which they had routed the imperial army, the Afghan forces laid siege to the capital and waited for the starved and terrified population of the city to surrender. Empty coffers and sheer incompetence of the Shah and his administration deprived Isfahan even of the backing of the Georgian mercenaries who had been summoned to the capital. During the 7-month siege, vital links with the outside were severed and the supply of provisions was blocked. Once the city dwellers had consumed the cats and dogs, they devoured rats, and reports of eating corpses became rampant. Then the disease-ravaged city caved and defences crumbled. Once inside the walls of Isfahan, Mahmud and his troops rode through the deserted streets and bazaars before arriving at the Chehel Satun Palace. There, the Galzai Khan unceremoniously enthroned himself as Mahmud Shah. He detained the royal family and divided up the Safavid household and the harem as booty for himself and his chiefs. It did not take long before he found himself presiding over an empire riddled with rebellion and chaos. What interested the Afghan invaders, however, was not the running of a broken empire, but the wealth of the capital and the glitter of royal edifices such as Chehel Satun, which whetted the invaders' appetite for plunder. At the outset, Mahmud tried to act graciously toward the people of Isfahan, and to some degree even to remedy the war-ravaged and starving capital. By the end of the Isfahan siege, nearly 80,000 inhabitants had perished. He also enjoyed the support of Jews and Zoroastrians of Isfahan and elsewhere in the empire, who had long felt the discrimination of the Safavids' religious policies. Yet soon his attitude began to change as he sensed persistent loyalty to the Safavids within the Divan and among the population at large. Insecure and paranoid, he quickly resorted to violence. He executed nearly all of Sultan Hussein's sons and relatives. The Shah himself was spared, only to later die at the hand of Ashraf, Mahmud's nephew and successor. A vast number of the ranking officials who ran the Safavid Divan also fell victim to repeated massacres that were motivated by the Afghans' fear of mass uprising. Even the Armenians, considered the Safavids' favoured minority, did not fare any better. The city quarter of New Julfa was plundered, houses and churches destroyed, and women and children enslaved. The occupation of Isfahan and the collapse of the Safavids sent signals to the former empire's western neighbours. Almost immediately, a new Ottoman campaign was launched by the Pasha of Baghdad under the pretext of restoring the former Safavid Shah to the throne. In response, in 1726, Ashraf Hotaki, whose survival on the Iranian throne was at the stake, executed Sultan Hussein and sent his head to the Ottoman Pasha as proof of the Safavids' demise. Even if the last of the Safavid Shahs could have repelled the Afghans, it is debatable whether the demise of the dynasty could have been averted. Climate, insolvency, and invasion. Whatever the shortcomings of late Safavid rule and the defects of its administration and army, the surprise Afghan invasion and the sudden fall of the Safavid state deserves further explanation. The expulsion of the Afghan occupiers less than a decade after the fall of Isfahan did not bring back peace and tranquility to Iran. The failed attempt to restore Safavid rule under Tahmasp II and the consequent rise to power of the tribal strongman Nader Shah Afshar, reigned 1736 to 1747, instead ushered in a period of extraordinary turmoil. With the exception of short-lived interludes, material destruction, urban, agricultural, and commercial decline continued almost to the end of the 18th century. One underlying factor of this decline may be the tribal resurgence, which was possibly caused by climate change that was taking place over the whole of the Eurasian landmass. The impact of this climate change, the so-called Little Ice Age, has primarily been studied in the context of 17th century Europe, but Western Asia also was affected by these changes. The late decades of the 17th century and early decades of the 18th century seem to have witnessed a period of drier and colder air, with longer and harsher winters and less rainfall in the spring. In Western Asia, the sudden outbreak of nomadic unrest and the perennial pattern of peripheral resurgence affected not only Iran, but also the far more populated and wealthier Mughal and Ottoman empires. On the Iranian plateau, the shaping of new Afghan warring confederacies, both the Ghalzai takeover of Kandahar and the occupation of Herat by the rival Abdali tribes, may be attributed to the same climatic changes. It is likely that the nomadic and semi-nomadic pastoral Afghans in the highlands of the Hindu Kush, who decades earlier had descended to the adjacent plains, could no longer sustain a growing population because of colder weather and scarce pasture land. The simultaneous rise of the Baluch tribes in the Makran, the Kurdish tribes in northwestern Iran, and the Cossacks and Lezgins in the Transcaucasus, all soon followed by unrest among the Afsharids and other tribes of Khorasan, the Kurdish tribes of the northern and eastern Iranian periphery, and the confederacy of frontier Turkmens in the northeast, may also be contributed to the same phenomenon. From the middle of the 17th century, not only the periphery, but also the Safavid heartlands suffered hardship due to intemperate weather. Contemporary European reports about Safavid Iran observe that within a short span of two decades, from the 1650s to the 1670s, agricultural production fell drastically, perhaps by as much as half. Repeated crop failures and recurring droughts coincided with the shrinking of the agricultural hinterlands, decline of trade in Persian Gulf and Mediterranean ports, and the depopulation of the cities. The impacts were so evident that in 1666, the royal astrologer, fearing an ominous celestial conjunction, advised the Safavid ruler to abdicate his throne, only nominally, so as to avoid ongoing calamities. He was then reinstated to the throne with the freshly assumed name Shah Soleiman. The investiture, though, did not change the empire's fortunes. When Jean Chardin visited Iran for the second time in the 1670s, he encountered a country weakened by natural and man-made calamities, a fact that other visitors of the time also attested to. The Afghan invasion was not the last of the tribal insurgencies that ravaged the Iranian countryside and damaged cities throughout the 18th century. The nomadic inroads were marked by violence and by the nomads' mass-scale decimation, mutilation, and displacement of people. Increased access to firearms, in particular, greatly enhanced tribal capabilities. It is quite likely that the dissipation of Safavid armies and concurrent dispersal of the state arsenals offered the restive tribes of the frontier, and soon after the nomads of the interior, an unprecedented firepower. Throughout the 18th century, Iranian cities suffered from recurring occupations by competing tribes, the destruction of residential quarters, the collapse of the bazaar economy, and insecurities that seriously disrupted travel and trade. Administrative malfunction and domestic turbulence hastened the collapse of the already troubled Safavid silk trade. The Arab privateers of the Oman coasts, who had successfully evicted the Portuguese from Muscat and created a maritime power in the Persian Gulf, were the latest in a series of threats to Iranian trade. Earlier, the near monopoly of the silk trade by the Dutch had weakened Portuguese and British competition and helped undermine the state-backed Armenian commercial enterprises and network. The Safavid state welcomed the commercial overtures from the French in the final decades of the 17th century. The Safavids' failure to persuade the Portuguese, still lingering on the horizon, to fight back against the threat of Omani pirates, made French intervention desirable. But the French, too, proved unwilling to venture into the hazardous waters of the Persian Gulf, while they were also fighting against English supremacy south of the Indian subcontinent. French representatives engaged in Safavid court intrigues and in the missionary politics of Isfahan, without offering any substantive alternative to other maritime powers in the region. Nor were the Safavids able to benefit from their French connection to compete effectively through the alternative Levantine route. The attacks by the Baluch tribes on Bandar Abbas in 1721 and the pillaging of the Dutch and English factory houses there was an ominous prelude of the troubles still to come. They soon wiped out much of the long-distance trade in the south. Not until the beginning of the 19th century did trade in the Persian Gulf recover, and even then it did not reach the heights of the Safavid period. The decline of the silk-producing centres of Gilan and the Shirvan was further hastened by the Afghan occupation. The nascent commercial bourgeoisie of the Safavid cities never mustered the financial resources or the political prestige to be able to avert this course of events. The empire's fundamentally agrarian economy, based on centuries-old practices of sharecropping, became more susceptible to bureaucratic abuse in the late Safavid period. The gradual shift from the Gezilbash-held land tenure to crown land and the appropriation of the old fiefdoms granted by the state as private property only added to the peasantry's burden. The diminishing revenue from booty, trade, and crown lands, the latter due to mismanagement and corruption, demanded heavier taxation on private land at a time when income from properties was dwindling because of agricultural shortfalls and depopulation of the countryside. The tax burden and inflationary pressures, even before the fall of the Safavids, became intolerable enough under Suleiman and Sultan Hussein that the peasants and nomads had to be forcibly kept on the land and prevented from fleeing. This policy of near serfdom, previously alien to the Islamic world, may help explain the explosion of restlessness among the nomadic and semi-nomadic tribes once the central state had largely collapsed. The relocation policy of warring nomads by the Safavid government from one place to another, and their reallocation from one tribe to another, which was the routine practice under Tahmasp I and Abbas I, had created a highly volatile pattern of displacement, with the potential to ultimately lead to breakup once the state no longer possessed the military resources for surveillance and coercion. Safavid Iran had a far smaller and more vulnerable economy than that of its imperial neighbours. Whereas the population of Safavid Iran probably never grew beyond 10 million, by the early 18th century, the neighbouring Mughal Empire ruled over a population of over 100 million, and the Ottomans over more than 22 million. The Safavids, even at the best of their time, could not exact from their landed population the gigantic revenues available to their competitors. That Iran's agrarian economy historically was susceptible to nomadic pressure and to state mismanagement may offer further explanation for Safavid agrarian decline. By the last decades of the 17th century, Safavid Iran had fully suffered the consequences of a global inflationary crisis that, since the 16th century, had affected the fortunes of Eastern empires. The large volumes of New World gold and silver injected into Western European economies gave those economies enormous purchasing power vis-à-vis the agrarian economies of Asia. This resulted in the devaluation of the silver-based currencies of the Ottoman Empire and Iran. Inflationary pressures in the form of depreciating currency, as well as higher costs of overland trade and prices for agricultural products, not only weakened the once prosperous Safavid mercantile class, but also reduced the empire's ability to defend itself. A shortage of currency, hoarding by state authorities and the privileged classes, drainage of currency, and overall weakening of the agrarian base intensified the empire's fiscal crisis. In particular, the siphoning off of Persian silver by the Dutch and English trading companies to Europe and by Indian traders, Bonyans, to the subcontinent had a long-term negative impact. This was a lucrative trade that went on for more than a century hand in hand with the silk trade. Despite the apparent abundance of New World silver in European markets, it was still beneficial to the trading companies to smuggle Iranian silver in the form of bullion for a handsome profit. Despite repeated Safavid measures to stop the drainage of currency, between 1642 and 1660, the Dutch East India Company smuggled the equivalent of more than 9 million guilders from Iran, a gigantic drainage of spices profoundly contributive to the Safavid insolvency. In a similar manner, the Dutch remained in their Persian Gulf factories even at the darkest hours of the early 18th century, when there was little to gain from the declining silk export. The cycle of trade from Europe through the Ottoman Empire, Iran, and to Mughal India generated 3- to 4-fold profit for European trading companies at the expense of impoverishing the empires of the East. Even if the Safavids could have withstood nomadic pressures and embraced domestic challenges, they stood little chance against a fresh wave of foreign inroads. News of the Afghan invasion and the siege of Isfahan set in motion an intense race to annex Iran's northern and western provinces between the Ottomans and the fast-expanding Russian Empire. Counting on Iranian military vulnerability, in 1721 to 1722, the Russians dispatched a huge army first into the northern Caucasian provinces of Darband and Dagestan under Safavid suzerainty, and then southward to Gilan. Before the occupation, Peter the Great, reigned 1682 to 1721, was encouraged by reports from Isfahan that painted the northern Iranian provinces as ripe for conquest and annexation. The 13-year occupation of the greater part of the Caucasus, Gilan, Mozandaran, and Astarabad, though in cahoots with the Ottomans, proved disastrous not only to Iran, but also to Russia. The ravages of malaria were one of several reasons for the hasty Russian withdrawal. This was the first Russian sortie along the Caspian shores, presaging a course of expansionism that, for the next 270 years, placed Russia at the center of Iran's foreign policy. In 1723, the Ottomans capitalized on the waning of their traditional enemy and crossed Iran's western border to attack the Safavid Caucasus without any provocation. This was the fourth wave of Ottoman expansion since 1514. A contest thus began between the Russians and the Ottomans to partition the northern Safavid provinces. As in earlier instances, the Ottomans aimed to recoup territory in the east while retreating in the Balkans to the Austrian Habsburgs. By 1725, successive Ottoman campaigns resulted in the loss of a vast swath of Iranian territory stretching from Georgia and Armenia to the western provinces of Ardabil, Tabriz, Kermanshah, Hamadan, and southwestern Iran. Earlier in 1722, the Ottomans supported the Afghan invasion and even sent a contingent to Mahmud's aid. However, they later changed their position under Ashraf Mahmud's nephew and successor, in favour of restoring Safavid rule, presumably because the Afghan regime in Isfahan was willing to go to war and recapture the Iranian provinces lost to the Ottomans. In 1725, Ashraf Hotaki, reigned 1725 to 1729, assassinated his mad uncle, Mahmud Galzai, ascended the throne and began to mobilise his forces against the Ottoman invaders. Despite relative success on the battlefield, Ashraf had a weakness. Both the Ottomans and the Russians preferred to negotiate with Tahmasp II, Sultan Hussein's surviving son, and the powerless claimant to the Safavid throne. Escaping the Afghans' ever-shrinking circle, the wandering Tahmasp's only recourse was to comply with the territorial demands of his neighbours, in the vain hope of being recognised as the legitimate ruler of Iran and eventually restoring the Safavid throne. For the same reason, Ashraf agreed to the humiliating treaties that ceded vast parts of Iran to the occupying Ottomans and the Russians. His stance was further impaired when, in 1726, he decided to execute the incarcerated Shah Sultan Hussein so as to remove any possibility of Safavid restoration in Isfahan. By 1727, Safavid Iran had nearly ceased to exist as an empire. The Afghans, their rule harsh and alien to the Shi'i Iranians, held only a semblance of control over what was left of Iran. Within a few short years, not only the most prosperous northern and western provinces were snatched away, cities and countryside throughout the empire were depleted, nomadic forces on the periphery were in rebellion, and confidence in the culture and social order was at its lowest ebb. Even the extensive Safavid state archives in Isfahan were completely destroyed by the invading Afghans, obliterating more than two centuries of dynastic and administrative records. In the meantime, Tahmasp was blundering his way through northern Iran. He settled briefly in Ghazvin, then Ardabil, and next in Tehran, which marked the first time this small, leafy town on the outskirts of the Elburz Range would become a seat of power. He finally arrived in Astarabad, a northwestern hub where the Khan of the Qajar tribe, a member of the Gezilbash Confederacy, was his host. Virtually a puppet in the hands of his many ministers, Tahmasp found in Fat Ali Khan Qajar a protector and a determined kingmaker. Yet the Qajars were destined to lose the contest for control of the Safavid Shah and restoration of the empire to a more potent contender, Nader Gholi, the future Nader Shah Afshar, whose appearance on the stormy political horizon raised hopes for Safavid restoration. Nader Gholi as the liberator. Few leaders in recent Iranian history have provoked such conflicting sentiments as Nader Shah Afshar, reigned 1736 to 1747, a military genius who emerged out of the post-Safavid interregnum to put an end to foreign occupations and soon to the Safavid dynasty itself. His countrymen viewed him first as a restorer of the empire and a saviour, but later a tyrant and a maniac. For his contemporary Europeans, he was a thundering conqueror whose Indian campaign paved the way for British colonial domination. To the incoming Qajar dynasty, he was a despicable usurper, yet in the Pahlavi era he was glorified as a hero and a forerunner of national unity, a prototype of a sort for Reza Shah, who admired him for his discipline and resolve. Today he is still part of Iran's nationalist narrative, appealing to pan-Iranian sentiments of some and anti-clerical aspirations of others. Beyond the constructs of the later centuries, however, Nader looms large as a unique phenomenon, in some ways reasserting tribal identity of the Iranian periphery, and in other ways as a prototype anticipating the nationalist trends of later centuries. Born around 1698 to a poor herding family among the Turkmen nomads of northern Khorasan, Nader Gholi belonged to the Gereglu subdivision of the Afshar tribe, one of the original members of the Gezilbash. The Gereglu had been resettled in the hinterlands of Mashhad under Abbas I, primarily to repel frequent incursions by the Uzbeks, who pillaged widely and enslaved the Shi'i residents of towns and villages. As a youth, he apparently was taken captive by the Uzbeks, living as a hostage slave for 4 years, before escaping captivity and leading a life of banditry. Soon after, Nader Gholi joined Malek Mahmud Sistani, a self-styled claimant to the legendary Kayanid dynasty of the Shahnameh. In the years following the collapse of the Safavid state, he had carved out territory for himself that stretched from northern Khorasan to Sistan, with his capital in Mashhad. Relying on a loose tribal and urban coalition, Malek Mahmud soon viewed Nader, then a local warlord, and his band of nomadic horsemen as a threat to his aspirations. It is not unlikely that his claim to kingship of the legendary dynasty, complete with an invented Kayanid crown and regal symbolism, inspired Nader's image of himself as champion of a unified Iran, a concept of authority different from the Safavids' claim to Shi'i sacred kingship. Nader nevertheless lost out to Malek Mahmud in the struggle for control of Mashhad. He returned to the life of a benevolent bandit, as his largesse helped at times to swell the ranks of his supporters. By 1725, when he offered his services to Tahmasp II, he probably mustered no more than 2,000 horsemen with shaky loyalty and no artillery or other heavy weapons. What he really offered to Tahmasp, who was helplessly vacillating among several tribal contenders, was an instinctive ability to lead, military talent, and tactful strategizing. Soon, he elevated himself to become Tahmasp's regent after successfully masterminding the slaying of his Qajar rival. This was the first step in a willful struggle that eventually brought him to the throne of Iran. Adopting the title Tahmasp Gholi, slave of Tahmasp, within a year he was able to secure his base in Khorasan and sack Mashhad, removing Malek Mahmud. Soon after, in a series of successful campaigns, in 1727 he first subdued the restive Abdali Afghans in Herat and prepared to march against the occupying Ghalzai Afghans in Isfahan. Routing Ashraf's forces in two battles, first near Damghan and then in Mirchehort in the vicinity of Isfahan, in December 1729 he triumphantly entered the Safavid capital in the company of Tahmasp II. Restoring the Safavid Shah to his throne added to Nader's prestige, although the pillage and killing of Isfahan's population by the Liberation Army was an ominous sign of what was to come. Marching two fars, he pushed the demoralized Afghan forces southeast. Ashraf and a few of his companions were killed on their way to Kandahar, but the remnant of troops who survived the battle conveniently joined Nader's forces. In an ever-growing enterprise for conquest, he soon turned his attention toward the provinces under Ottoman and Russian occupation. Key to Nader's early successes and his meteoric rise was a talent for organizing disjointed tribal groups into an army. These included Kurdish tribes of Khorasan, some of the Qajars and their Turkmen allies, the Baluch and other tribes of the southeast, the Abdali and Khalzai Afghans, and even the Uzbeks. He often took command of these desperate nomadic forces by enticing their chiefs to join him, only to eliminate them at an opportune moment. What made his enterprise different from familiar Turco-Mongolian tribal ventures of the past was that the multi-ethnic character of Nader's army also incorporated a contingent of peasants displaced from the interior. Perhaps for the first time in Iranian history, and possibly in the history of empires in the region, his crude method of drafting able-bodied men from remote villages and towns, often without serious resistance, set the precedent for a new conscription army. Comparable to similar European armies of his time, Nader's drive for a disciplined military force increasingly entailed an element of proto-national integration. Long campaigns, under unified command, and with the reward of shared booty, instilled a sense of unanimity and emphasized pronounced elements of shared identity, such as standardized insignia in campaigns, the use of Shahnameh legendary motifs, and later the creation of a new royal crown for himself instead of the Safavid Gezilbash cap. The effective use of firearms, matchlocks, and light artillery, with which he quickly equipped his army once he got hold of the Safavid arsenal in big cities, also proved crucial in giving Nader's troops mobility and tactical advantage, and in boosting their morale and semblance of a modern military discipline. Nader himself became a champion of national assertiveness, distinct from the late Safavid's public image of debauchery on the one hand and excessive religiosity on the other. Even before taking Isfahan, Nader was adamant that he would repulse the Ottoman occupation, with force if necessary. But unlike campaigns of the Safavid era, Nader did not rely on the Shi'i identity to garner support. Rather, he was campaigning against Ottomans almost purely on territorial grounds. It was as though prevailing over the Afghan enemy sublimated, at least momentarily, Nader's personal ambitions into a patriotic objective tied to defending the guarded domains and preserving Iran's territorial integrity. As it turned out, this was a project different from carving out a tribal kingdom for himself with no specific geographical boundary and no ties to its subjects. Beginning in 1730, Nader, now acting as the Safavid regent, reclaimed most western provinces in a series of brilliant campaigns. Despite Ottoman reinforcements to fight the unexpected rise of the new contender, the resounding defeat of the Turkish army generated a serious crisis in Istanbul and contributed to the abdication of Sultan Ahmad III, reigned 1703 to 1730. Nader's military pressure to recapture the province of Baghdad and the Shi'i holy cities, however, met stiff Ottoman resistance. The loss of Baghdad would have been a serious blow to Ottoman prestige and its strategic and commercial interests. With his troops stranded at the Western Front, Nader sensed a greater need for Shi'i solidarity. To display his Shi'i loyalty, he repaired and gilded Shi'i shrines in Mashhad and Shiraz. Although he frowned on the demoralized clerical establishment, he still acted with loyalty to the Safavid sovereign. But this lasted for only a short while. Tahmasp's failure to repulse a renewed Ottoman offensive in the west and the subsequent loss of nearly all the territory Nader had temporarily secured gave the latter the long-awaited excuse to remove Tahmasp. In 1732, in a carefully staged scene in an Isfahan palace designed to display Tahmasp's nocturnal debauchery, Nader persuaded the state notables and chiefs of the army to depose the Shah and replace him on the throne with his 8-month-old son, Abbas III, for whom Nader was regent. As the de facto ruler of the country some 7 years after his emergence, Nader could act with greater facility in making new administrative and military appointments in his favour. He levied heavy taxes to finance a series of campaigns that, between 1732 and 1736, restored all of the western and northwestern Iranian provinces occupied by the Ottomans, including Georgia, Armenia, and the economically rich Shamakhi, and even established footholds in Ottoman Iraq. Nader's forces crushed the Lezgin revolt in the Caucasus, defeated the restive Ghalzai Afghans, and forced them back to Kandahar, recaptured Herat, restrained the Turkmens of northern Khorasan, forced the Russians to fully evacuate the Caspian provinces, and reasserted control over the Persian Gulf. It seemed as though Safavid rule, nominal though it was, had finally restored stability and calm to the empire. From Mogan to Hindustan. The long shadow of the Son of the Sword, as Nader often referred to his own lineage, had already been cast over the guarded domains. In the winter of 1736, he summoned to the plain of Mogan on the bank of the Aras River in northern Azerbaijan a great assembly of khans and notables to consider the future of the Iranian state. It was an open secret that the ambitious slave of Tahmasp was ready to abolish Safavid rule altogether and make the Persian throne his own. Of the nearly 20,000 dignitaries who were present in the Mogan assembly, reportedly only a single Sheikh al-Islam, the chief clerical authority of the last Safavid sovereign, dared to express, in private, the Iranian people's sympathy for the Safavid house. Overheard by informants, he was brought into Nader's presence and duly executed, setting a clear example for other potential voices of dissent still loyal to the Safavids. The large gathering of patricians, urban officials, religious leaders, including the Patriarch of the Armenian Church, state officials, and army chiefs from all over the country, albeit a rubber stamp assembly, was meant to signify the consent of the country's elite. Perhaps inspired by the Mongolian tribal gatherings of the Ilkhanid era, The Mogan Assembly was the first time that the notion of representation was introduced to the Iranian milieu. Moreover, Nader justified deposing the Safavid monarchy and his own reluctance to carry the burden of kingship on the grounds of restoring Iranian sovereignty when the Safavids were no longer fit to rule the country. The greatest divergence from the Safavid concept of authority, however, was Nader's extraordinary, and as it turned out quite impolitic, call to relinquish Shi'ism as the religious creed of Iran, at least in the way it was practiced under the Safavids. This was one of three conditions he set forth in Mogan for his acceptance of the crown of Iran. His declaration also called for total loyalty to himself and the abandoning of any sympathy for the house of the Safavids and hope for their future restoration. Instead of the Safavids' 12-heir Shi'ism, which in his view had long been divisive internally and offensive to Iran's Sunni neighbours, Nader proposed the relatively improvised Ja'fari creed after the 6th Shi'i Imam, Ja'far Sadegh, who died in 765. Devoid of anti-Sunni exclusivity, messianic longing, and juristic tradition, Nader's Ja'fari brand seemed to be a diluted form of the Safavid state-dominated creed. More than two centuries of religious conflict, which had facilitated the Afghan invasion, must have persuaded Nader, whose own career, oddly enough, had been built on expelling Sunni invaders, to see the ills of an exclusionist form of Shi'ism. He hoped that declaring the Ja'fari creed would persuade the Ottomans to comply with the terms of his peace proposal, which called for the establishment in Mecca for the Shi'i pilgrims of a fifth platform around the Kaaba, literally Rokan, pillar, adjacent to that of the Hanafis, which was to be taken as recognition of Shi'ism as a legitimate Islamic creed. Yet there were other implicit motives behind Nader's conciliatory move. His army included among its ranks a growing number of Afghans, Uzbeks, and other Sunni mercenaries whose loyalty to Shi'i rule for the cause of a Shi'i empire was in doubt. On a deeper level, Nader, who earlier in his life seemed to have adhered to Sunnism, realized that minimizing Sunni-Shi'i differences would enhance his chances for conquering Sunni lands. Annexing southern Iraq, eastern Anatolia, and perhaps beyond, seemed within his reach, given the visible signs of the Ottomans' disarray. Here, perhaps for the first time in a political context, the notion of a pan-Islamic solidarity, Etihad-e-Islam, found expression in Nader's conciliatory proposal, which, though it never materialized, denoted a shift away from the creed-based Ottoman and Safavid Muslim empires. As it turned out, Nader's proposal was unacceptable to both sides. To the Shi'is of Iran, being an inconsequential subsidiary of the Sunni Hanafis was a humiliating reversal of their Shi'i identity, despite all the Sunni hostilities. To the Ottoman authorities, who for two centuries were angered by the rude anti-Sunni propaganda of Safavid Iran, even partial recognition of Shi'ism was an anathema. Imagining himself as a new Timur, or even an Ismail, Nader's first major move after the Mogan Assembly was to conquer Kandahar, the homeland of the Ghalzai Afghans. Rather than claiming vengeance or even reclaiming the plundered Safavid riches or recruiting a larger number of Afghan mercenaries to his expanding army, Nader's main goal was to capture the strategic gateway to Mughal India. The rise of a new sectarian conscience in the 18th century Islamic world, as evident in renewed Afghan and Ottoman Sunni aggressions against the Safavids, coincided with a rapid decline of the Ottoman and Mughal empires on both Iran's eastern and western borders. Yet militarily, the Ottomans were effective enough to slow Nader's western advances, which in turn persuaded the Iranian conqueror, desperate for funds, to abandon his anti-Ottoman campaigns and look eastward once it became clear that his pan-Islamic project would not render the desired benefit. At the most basic level, Nader's ambition was to access the Mughal Empire at its most vulnerable time, to plunder its riches, and to use these exploits to defeat his Ottoman nemesis. The urge to conquer Hindustan, as the Indian subcontinent was known, became irresistible when he realized that the impoverished people of Iran could no longer sustain the cost of his territorial ambitions. By contrast, Mughal India was a long-time repository of circulated precious metals of the Old World, which had accumulated over centuries. Even though, as early as the 16th century, the European trading companies had drained off substantial quantities of Indian gold and silver, there was enough left to entice Nader and his army chiefs. Success on the battlefield, despite some Mughal resistance, proved the worth of Nader's Indian campaign. Having first secured the walled city of Kandahar in 1738 and razed it to the ground, he used the last of the Ghalzai stronghold to build adjacent to the old city the new city of Naderabad, named in his own honour. He then moved on to capture with relative ease the major urban centres of Peshawar, Kabul and Lahore. His eastward expansion into northern India was beyond anything a northern power had ever explored since the Afghan conquest of Sher Shah Suri 2 centuries earlier. Yet the agonizing breakup of the Mughal Empire during the first half of the 18th century had turned it into an easy target for Nader's invasion, and soon after for colonial exploits. Nader routed the lackadaisical Indian armies in Karnal, north of Delhi, in February 1739. In the course of the battle, he defeated the numerically superior Mughal army and triumphantly entered Delhi. That he almost immediately agreed to reinstate to the throne the desperate Nasir ad-Din Muhammad Shah, reigned 1719 to 1748, reaffirmed Nader's predatory intent. The unfortunate emperor reportedly surrendered his entire royal treasure, consisting of ancestral jewels, precious metals, and other objects of value. In addition, the conquering army levied a hefty toll on Delhi notables. Nader's total take reportedly amounted to several hundred million rupees, one of the largest booties ever extracted in early modern history. Among many dazzling items that would later adorn the Persian and the British royalty were the two great diamonds, Kuh-e-Noor, or Kuh-i-Noor, Mountain of Light, and Dariya-e-Noor, or Dariya-i-Noor, Sea of Light, and the legendary Peacock Throne, Taht-e-Tavas, built by the Mughal Emperor Shah Jahan. Nader's avarice did not spare the resisting population of Delhi. His troops, drunk and fierce, rampaged through the city, raping and plundering. A popular revolt in response cost the lives of 3,000 of Nader's mercenaries. In retaliation, Nader ordered a massacre of the city population, which, within a few hours, reportedly took the lives of as many as 20,000 civilians. Collapse of a fragile empire. After returning from his Indian campaign, Nader amassed his Indian spoils in the impenetrable fortress of Chalate Naderi, near his birthplace in northern Khorasan. Hoarding at such massive scale was meant to finance his world-conquering project, whereas his merciless acts of violence were meant to instill fear in his impoverishing subjects. The darkening image of Nader, despite the awe he inspired in the European press of the time, did not bring prosperity or stability to his empire. On the contrary, military success whetted his appetite to extort, with cruelty matched only by his historical role models. Some contemporary authors eulogized him for reviving the Changizian rites, while others depicted horrifying scenes of atrocities committed against defenseless towns and villages. Marauding across the land from Mesopotamia and the Transcaucasus to Central Asia, the Persian Gulf, and the interiors of Hindustan, and fighting destructive wars, led to the image of short-lived empire devoid of a center of gravity or a sustainable imperial vision. With Iran's resources stretched to their limits, he left behind a ruined agrarian economy, little trade and manufacture, and decimated administrative infrastructure. It was as if Nader and his army represented a nomadic revenge of the periphery against Iran's urban centres. During the following 8 years of his reign, Nader's ceaseless campaigns to recapture Iraq and Anatolia, with the aim of accessing the Black Sea, brought mixed results. He seriously threatened the stability of the Ottoman eastern provinces. It seemed as though he would prevail. Yet long campaigns and even longer sieges did not deliver Iraq to Nader's empire. The frequency of rebellions of the Baloch who were allied with tribes of the interiors of Fars province, and the Afghans and Kurds of northern Khorasan, compelled him to rush back to the east. Predictably, the Sublime Porte also rejected his proposal for recognition of the Jafari creed. Likewise, his punitive action against Dagestani mountain people in hopes of stabilizing the Iranian Caucasus, and his repeated campaigns against the Turkmens of the northeast and the Lur Confederacy in the Iranian interior proved ephemeral. Nader's unrelenting campaigning and the movement of large armies across the country devastated what was left of the prosperity of the Iranian cities and the countryside. His forced relocation of the nomadic populations was as disruptive as his appointment of Afghan, Turkmen, Kurd, and other Sunni tribal commanders to military governorships of the Persian provinces. His confiscation of private property and the appropriation of vast Safavid charitable endowments, though aimed to stop rampant corruption and raise more revenue, actually added to fiscal confusion. Heavy taxation weakened the peasants and the landowning elite alike. Forced conscription alienated the rural population, and at the city gates, tall conical structures made of his victims' skulls were a gruesome reminder of Nader's frenzied rage. What eventually cost Nader his life, however, was not the dismal treatment he inflicted on his subjects, but his evident inability to strike a balance in his multi-ethnic army. His progressive insanity, which erupted in bursts of violence, fueled the fire of ethno-religious tension among his officers and troops. Relying heavily on Uzbek and Afghan mercenaries, he had planned to eliminate the growing opposition among his Persian officers and troops. Yet, before he could put his coup into action, he was assassinated in June 1747 in his camp in northern Khorasan, while attempting to quell yet another rebellion among the Kurds of the region. A group of Afshar and other Iranian military chiefs attacked him while he was sleeping in the royal tent. Despite his desperate resistance, they managed to kill him. They dispatched his severed head to his nephew Herat, who collaborated in the plot, as an invitation to succeed his uncle on the throne. The mostly Shi'i Iranian faction among his troops, who had now regrouped under the title of Gezilbash, had felt threatened by Nader's ominous drift toward his Afghan and Uzbek mercenaries. The latter, under the command of Ahmad Khan Abdali, later known as Ahmad Shah Durrani, reigned 1747 to 1773, posed a serious challenge. In the Iranian faction's emphasis on the Gezilbash identity, more a memory than an institutional reality, one may trace a desire not only to check the Afghan presence, but also to restore some form of Safavid rule. Nader's failure to put an end to post-Safavid tribal turmoil cost Iran dearly. Though he aimed to create a stable imperial model distinct from the Safavids, he essentially remained a tribal chief in control of a formidable war machine devoted to conquest. His capital, as he was quoted as saying, was on the back of his horse, and his disgust for the machinery of government was evident in his consistent crushing of the old Safavid bureaucracy and haphazard replacement of it with a military elite. His policy of de-emphasizing Shi'ism and disengaging from its clerical core never led to a tolerant alternative. It became apparent that the people of Iran, at least of the Persian-speaking urban centers, no longer would abandon Shi'ism. It is therefore not surprising that shortly after his accession, the Persian urban public of the interiors viewed him as a usurper of the Safavid throne. Soon, a string of pretenders to the Safavid throne raised among the populace with messianic hopes for restoration of the demised dynasty. An obscure dervish from Rafsanjan, one of several who claimed to be Safi Mirza, the younger son of Shah Sultan Hussein, rebelled against Nader during his siege of Mosul in 1744. He was first given refuge in Istanbul in 1729 in the hopes that he could advance the Ottoman objective in the power scramble in progress in Iran. As Shah Safi II, he was encouraged to rise against Nader, but his enterprise came to no fruitful end. Once he had proved useless, the Ottomans sent him off to the exile on the island of Rhodes, where he died in obscurity some years later. Other pretenders were no more successful.